Welcome to Vantage Point Podcast, a podcast brought to you by NWR Communications and 92 Studio. This podcast is intended for education and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute financial advice. G'day and welcome to the latest episode of Vantage Point, where we aim to get behind the leading minds who are driving success in the Australian market. And today, we're fortunate enough to have Hashan De Silva, the founder and managing partner of KPRX Healthcare Opportunities Fund. KPRX is a specialist healthcare fund backed by Caspek Capital. It specialises in healthcare and health tech investments in Australia and New Zealand. Previously, he was the head of the healthcare of Caspek Capital, leading the firm's investments in healthcare. And prior to Caspek, he was the lead healthcare analyst at CLSA and also worked at Macquarie Bank. We hope you enjoy the episode. Hashan, thanks very much for joining us today. Obviously, just about to launch KPRX. Before we sort of get back into that, can you just give us a bit of a background professionally before we get into the fund?
Yeah, if I start all the way back at the start. So I started my journey in med school. I moved to Sydney to study medicine at UNSW. And very early on, I realized I didn't want to practice medicine. And so I looked at alternative careers and I decided to shift to work at a big drug company called Eli Lilly. And I was there for about 5 years. One of the last things I did there was working on a drug that we had acquired from a small Aussie company. And I was a very junior member on that team. And I had my light bulb moment of where I realized what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I left Lilly. I went back to uni. I did a Master of Finance, did the CFA. And then I worked at Macquarie Bank and CLSA as a healthcare research analyst, covering listed healthcare, you know, marketing to various clients. And it was there where I met Caspek. And at Caspek, I went on board to be the head of healthcare research, investing across Asia Pacific in various healthcare assets. And towards the end of my time at Caspek, I negotiated to spin out to start KPRX in the same vein that Caspek spun out of Tiger to start Caspek. I spun out of Caspek to start KPRX. And
baby tiger to baby tiger, baby extra baby cub sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I think they call us grand cubs.
Grand cubs,
we're so far removed, I don't even know why they bother.
So it was a risky move to make, you know, make the launch into KPRX, or is it just more of a sort of logical next step to really focus on the biotech space?
Yeah, I mean, when I left Lilly all those years ago, it was my goal to start my own healthcare VC focused on Australian New Zealand innovation. And so when the opportunity presented itself, it's not something I could pass up. And yeah, we'll talk about it later, I assume, but where the market is as well, I think it's a very exciting time to be an investor.
Yeah, it's probably a good dovetail into the market. It's obviously been a pretty tumultuous time over the last 18 months in the biotech space. Launching a biotech fund has obviously been headwinds in terms of the backdrop of the space, but it's probably a good time in terms of valuations and whatnot. What's your read on why it's been so soft and why is it a good time to invest in a fund like KPRX?
Yeah, I think we had such a bull market in 2021. It was a crazy bull market, right? We actually didn't invest that much in 2021 at Caspek because we were getting crowded out from a lot of deals because we weren't willing to pay the valuations that the market was willing to assign to some of these assets. And now we're just seeing that correction. We're seeing with high net worth and other investors, they're supporting their portfolio companies because they're struggling to raise capital. They're struggling to commercialize. Then with institutional LPs or institutional investors, they're not getting the returns from their fund managers, so they're not able to then deploy into new fund managers. So if you're trying to raise a new fund, the two buckets of money you've got, high net worth and insto, are both tapped. So that makes it quite difficult. But in the traditional way of thinking, in a buy low, sell high, this is when the market is low. This is when you should be buying. It turns out that everyone thinks they want to buy low and sell high, but people actually don't. They want to buy high and sell higher.
Yeah.
And so while it's a difficult time to raise a fund, this is the best time to deploy capital into healthcare assets I've seen in my career. And speaking with other people that have been in the markets longer than I have, they're saying that this is a bigger downturn than 08, bigger downturn than the genomics bubble, and bigger downturn than 01. So it's quite an interesting dynamic.
And in terms of the sort of 2020, 2021 sort of bubble, so to speak, is that just because a whole bunch of generalist funds rushed into these deals that not sort of biotech specific and can get away with the inflated valuations, or what do you make that out to?
That's a good question. I think there was a much more retail participation in the public markets that allowed a lot of companies to exit into public markets, which then incentivized fund managers to create these private to public funds that invested in anything. And if you could IPO'd in 6 months, you made 30% in 6 months, and then you just recycle that capital and off you go. And that created a bubble. But also, I mean, high net worths were very active in every healthcare deal. And we're seeing companies now that had raised a lot of money in 2021, had built this huge cost base, that are now having to raise money today at often down 90% or more. And it's not great for the people that invested in 2021, but it creates opportunities for if you're ready to invest in 2023.
No, exactly. It's the place to be, hopefully. And so just in terms of KRPX, what's the sort of structure, mandate? Is there a close in terms of, you know, firm that you're targeting? You know, is it private? Is it public? How many positions? What does that sort of look like?
Yeah. The fund is structured as a venture capital limited partnership with a unit trust sidecar. We can do private and public. So what we tell our investors is we can do up to 30% public. It might be zero, but it definitely won't be more than 30%. And the way we look at the two types of investments, I guess, are private and public. For us, there's no difference. They're both at the same stage of development, the same risks. One just happens to have a listed stock price. But that listed stock price is often worthless because the stock trades 1,000, 2,000 a day, exactly, by appointment. And so there's no liquidity and there's no price discovery. So we still structure the deal as if the companies were private. We don't really care if it's public or not. And so in terms of the type of companies we invest in, it's biotech, medtech, medical devices. We don't do hospitals or GP clinics. We tend to be a later stage investor than your typical healthcare VC. We come in, what I say, more at a Series B stage than at a Series, you know, than most investors that come in at preclinical or, you know, seed or pre-seed stage. We're looking to write a larger check into a proof of concept company that funds them. And we try to be the last or the second last money into the company before commercialization. So the fund is structured as a 10-year fund, but we call capital and we return capital to investors. We call capital as we invest and we return capital as we exit. And if you look at our past investments, entry to exit has been about 3 to 4 years. So we think the vast majority of capital will be returned to investors at the 5-year mark, but the fund is structured as a 10-year fund, which gives us flexibility that if we think by keeping that company private for longer, we can unlock some significant returns, we have the option to do so.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And in terms of a focus, is it all domestic or offshore as well?
Primarily ANZ. We're not actively out there looking for deal flow in the US or Europe. But let's say we're researching a company, for argument's sake, in bladder cancer in Australia. And as a part of our DD, we meet a company, you know, based in the US that we really like. We have the ability to invest up to 30% of the fund overseas.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, we're not actively looking for deals outside of Australia and New Zealand.
And in terms of, I know you've talked about your DD on different companies in the past, and Neuren in particular. Can you just sort of run us through, obviously, you've got the background in terms of the, you know, medical career and whatnot. What sort of extensive DD do you do, and how do you do it differently to the rest of the market?
So one thing we do differently, I think, over everyone else, we don't have an internal advisory board. And the reason for that, and if I can use Neuren as an example, Neuren's drug treats a rare neurodevelopmental disease called Rett syndrome. Even if I had a very large advisory board that happened to have one or two neurologists on that advisory board, likely those neurologists would have heard of Rett syndrome. And so what we do on a company-by-company basis, we create an external advisory board where we go out and seek the actual key opinion leaders. And so with Neuren, there are 25 centers of excellence in the U.S. for Rett syndrome. We spoke to all of them. I went over to two conferences in the U.S., one targeted towards the science and doctors, one actually for the parents, where I got to meet the parents and I got to meet everyone in the continuum of care. And through all of that DD, for Neuren, I think we created an advisory board of about 10 people. And they were very important and helped us do our DD when we entered, but they were also very important to know when we exited. So for instance, Neuren went from $1 a share when we invested to $3 after the phase 3 result came out. We didn't sell because we had a very good understanding of what the opportunity looked like in that market. It got to $8 before FDA. We didn't sell because we had a very high conviction that the FDA approval was going to come through. And then after FDA, I think it got to $10, $12, $13, and we still didn't sell because we knew, based on the people that we'd spoken to, what the ramp would look like and what the total addressable market was. And today, Neuren stock sits at $22, $23. And that's very important, right? I mean, we could have exited Neuren any of those gates, which you don't get that quality information on the market and on what's happening with the patients and payers and parents and, you know, and distribution.
Real time and detailed understanding.
Exactly, yeah. we've gone as far as, for instance, before we invested in Avida, we did a market survey of 50 burn centers, and there's only 200 burn centers in the US. Mm. That gave us a very good understanding of what that market was. And so when the stock went from $1 to $18, we had actually, we knew that the stock had surpassed what the market, what the total addressable market was for that indication. So we actually exited 20% of that company on marketing block trades to others. So we were selling when others were buying. And same with genetic signatures. And I think that's one of our key differentiations. I've also hired private investigators in the past to do background checks on management teams when I think it's warranted. So we do quite deep DD. The only risk that I want to take in a company is the technical risk, the clinical risk. And we try to mitigate all other risks.
So just to summarize that, so basically you don't have an internal board of advisors or advisory board per stock. You'll instill an advisory board specific to that company. Is that right?
Yeah. Like an external unofficial advisory board of people that we think that these are the people that we need to go and ask the questions of, are the KOLs in that disease state.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And just in terms of the short report on urine on the debut drug, what's your sort of thoughts on that? Just give us a bit of a background on that as well.
Yeah, so I think it was Culper Research released a short report on Acadia with a variety of points. And some of their points around side effects and discontinuations, it might have been news to them. I mean, they are a one-man band and it's one guy doing research on stocks, but it wasn't news to anyone else that's done DD on the stock, because when you look at the clinical trial, you can easily see that 80% of patients had diarrhea. That was known to everybody. So I think a lot of it was old news to us that was new news to him. Some of the other things were quite misleading. He characterized that, you know, X percent of patients were being hospitalized for diarrhea. Mm. Now, that's just incorrect. So you can actually pull the data from the FDA FEERS database to look at the side effects. And you can see that some of these patients were hospitalized for, one in particular, for appendicitis, that an appendectomy. And diarrhea was listed as one of the side effects that this patient had when they were admitted to hospital. But they weren't in hospital for diarrhea. Mm. They were there to get their appendix cut out. And then a whole bunch of others had pneumonia. They had diarrhea as well, but they weren't in hospital for diarrhea. They were there for pneumonia. So when you look through that database and see how many patients were actually admitted for diarrhea, it's far, far less. Mm. And then he claimed that 5 patients died because of debut. That is incorrect. You can pull the data up. I think 2 of them died. One of them died from an allergic reaction and 2 of them died from pneumonia. And so that is, I think, misleading. Mm. Maybe he didn't understand the data that he was presenting, and that's what caused the confusion. And then he used that same database to say that patient starts had topped out in August because the side effect reporting got to here and then kind of gradually went down. But to assume that will always grow at the rate of new patient starts assumes that if you're a mother with or a father with a daughter with Rett syndrome, you call the FDA every month to tell them that your daughter has diarrhea. Mm. I mean, that just doesn't happen, right? You might call them once or twice. And once that resolves or you understand how to manage that, you don't just keep reporting the side effect. Mm. So with most drug launches, you see the side effect profile or the side effect reporting go like that and go down. And the side effect reporting is not attributed to drug. Acadia as a company are obligated to report anything they hear, regardless if it can be attributed to drug or not. Mm. And so that database is not something that you can use to really do anything
rely
with.
On,
but that is kind of a real kind of core part of his thesis.
Mm, no, that makes sense. And just in terms of deal sourcing and whatnot, how much is it sort of originated from yourself and your connections, and how much do you sort of rely on brokers or advisors for deal flow? How do you look at that?
Yeah, so we will see nearly every deal that happens in Australia without having to actively source it.
Yeah,
and that's because these companies, where do they go? Mm. There are less than half a dozen specialist healthcare investors in Australia. And as I said, most of them specialize in pre-seed and seed. Mm. So if you're a company that is Series A, Series B, you're looking to raise money to do a phase 2 trial, you don't have very many places to go. And in this market, you need a specialist cornerstone in order to be able to raise money from anybody. Mm. And so companies approach us. We meet companies way before we're ready to invest in them. And by the time the company's got a broker, we've likely already met that company, half a dozen times. Yeah, that's really what we're going to do.
And so you act, you know, as a sort of specialist healthcare investor, more so as the validation point for them to launch a deal off the back of, I'm assuming?
Yep.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. And in terms of the existing investors who have come in so far or committed, what does the sort of makeup look like there? I'm assuming there's probably different sort of backgrounds of those that you've invested in the past and those sort of things. What's the sort of flavour that you've been seeing in terms of the fundraising process?
Yeah, so we've got 40 million pencils. The first close is in a couple of weeks. And the 40 million for us comes from, obviously, Cast Peak is a seed investor.
Yep.
And then three family offices, two in Melbourne, one in Sydney. And then a group of healthcare entrepreneurs. So we've got about 12 founders, CEOs, chairmen of various healthcare companies that understand the market, understand this is a great time to be buying. Most of them were actually management teams of our portfolio companies in Cast Peak, who are now supporting the new fund. So as examples, you know, we've got Patrick Davies, the chairman of Neuron.
Mm.
We've got Lou Panaccio, who's on the board of several different companies. We've got Chris Berenbrook, who's the CEO and founder of Telix. And so we really like that because I think that's one validation for others to know that people in the know are back in this fund, but also for in the future for our portfolio companies, we've got access to some amazing talent.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
That can help out as required.
You've got your own advisory board on
as investors. The fund.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And in terms of you previously served or had some time in the army, is that true? Or am I just making that up?
No, I did. Yeah, I joined the Army Reserves when I was 18 years old in the first year of med school.
And what did you take away from that? That you sort of now outlay into the investment world, anything or discipline? What does it sort of look like?
Yeah, so I spent 8 years in the Army. I went to RMC. I got my pips. I was a lieutenant. I was a commander of Aussie soldiers when I left. I think there's a lot that I don't realize that I know from the Army. Mm. I learned so much. I mean, I was an 18-year-old kid. I had just moved out of home. I remember I moved from home to living on campus in a college, which is almost like living at home.
Mm.
Yeah, because you've got the RAs and all your meals are cooked for you. And suddenly you dropped into this thing where you've got to fend for yourself and you got to grow up. So I think I grew up really fast.
Mm.
The only focus of RMC is to build leaders. I think that's a big area where the corporate world doesn't focus on enough. So we see that someone who's an individual contributor, let's say a sales rep or whatever it might be, the best sales rep will get promoted to the sales manager. But that best sales rep often doesn't make the best sales manager. And there's very limited training that goes to teach them how to be a leader. And we see that a lot, particularly in startups where you can't just hire someone to be a leader. Cash is tight. Everyone needs to do their part. So I think, discipline is very important. Concurrent activity. I think of the way I handle stress. I mean, my formative years was I learned in med school in the army. And so I generally view that my view is if someone isn't dying on my table or if someone isn't shooting at me, it can't be that stressful.
Mm. Sets you up pretty well for the markets.
Yeah. So I think I can make decisions under pressure pretty well. And I don't think I've ever felt stressed as an adult outside of the hospital or the army. So it's a good yardstick to measure everything.
Yeah, that puts it all in perspective momentarily. Probably just a bit of a curveball for a last question. In terms of KRPX, what's your biggest motive? Is it making money or investing in companies that develop drugs, like a Neuron that, fundamentally change lives?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
I love the purpose. I think making money for me alone is not enough.
Mm.
I noticed that when some of the other jobs that I did. The purpose that I have of creating these drugs that change hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of people's lives gets me out of bed and means that I can work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I don't really feel that tired.
Mm.
But these drugs are very, very profitable, right? So Neuron, I mean, we're up 20-something X, right?
Mm.
So it's both. And I believe the capital markets and the financial incentives behind the capital market is the best way to fund drug development. I don't think government does a pretty good job.
Mm.
I don't think universities are required in the early stage, but I don't think that capital allocation outside of the very early stage does a very good job. So you need investors like myself to take the risk in order for the reward to make sure that innovation happens. And I would challenge anyone to put forward an innovation that has happened in healthcare in the last 25 years that hasn't been driven by a for-profit
commercial purpose.
A commercial purpose. And I'll use, I mean, the example of melanoma, right? When I started med school, melanoma was largely a death sentence. If you had stage four melanoma, five-year survival was 20%, 15%. And today, melanoma five-year survival is, I think, over 80 or 90%. And that's been because of immuno-oncology. It's been because of PD-1 drugs that have been developed and sold by Merck and BMS, largely, that have solved, that have, word cured isn't the right word, but have transformed the treatment of those conditions. So people with stage four melanoma don't have to get their affairs in order anymore. And there's a whole, you know, a whole bunch of other blood cancers where that's the same. And you need the for-profit incentive in order to be able to drive these innovations.
Investing for purpose, I like it. Ashan, good luck with the close and the first investments. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers. Thanks.